This week on Notorious Scoundrels Podcast.
Yeah, basically Wookiee's just, taking fire from an AT-ST and charging straight into the breach.
Welcome to the Notorious Scoundrels Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Notorious Scoundrels Podcast, where Dashes and Archimedes from Never Tell Me the Odds join Endless from Yavin Base to talk about Star Wars Legion competitive play and improving your game. In this first episode, the Scoundrels will talk about a healthy competitive attitude, the Michigan Grand Tournament, Invader League, and how Boba Fett is altering the Imperial meta. But before we get any further, I'd like to do some introductions. So I'm going to start with Archimedes from Never Tell Me the Odds. What's up, buddy? Go ahead and tell us about yourself and who you are.
How's it going? So I started the Never Tell Me the Odds blog. I live in Northern Virginia area. Went to Nova. It was a blast. I also play in the Invader League on TTS. And I'd like to say that I'm a recovering 40K player, which means that I converted to Legion from 40K. So I've been doing miniatures games since I was 12.
Awesome. And we also have Dashes, who is also a member of the Never Tell Me the Odds blog, who had recently joined the team. What's up? Tell us about yourself.
Hey, I'm Dashes. I also live pretty close to Northern Virginia. I'm about 10 miles away from Ork. I'm sort of a recovering 40K addict, though I am coming more from a background of Armada and some competitive Magic play. That's about all I got.
All right, awesome. And rounding it all off, my name is Endless. I write the Yavin-based blog. I'm based out of California. I played competitive, or I still play competitive X-Wing for last year and a half or so. And then I got into Legion in March, and it's been a real blast since then. I've had so much fun with this game, and I've dedicated a lot of time and thought into playing it at a very high level. And so I started streaming games for the Invader League, which is an online league that we're going to talk about a little bit in more detail later on in the show. But I decided to just roll with it and stream games, and it's been a total blast. And X-Wing is like really my first competitive miniatures game, and I've been hooked on the FFG game since then. I still play a little bit of Age of Sigmar here and there, but I'm mostly a X-Wing Legion player. I play a little bit of Armada too, but sort of all around. So that's who I am. So great. So with that said, we're going to go ahead and jump right into our first topic, which is going to be since we are a competitive focused podcast, we're going to be focusing first off on the Michigan GT, which was a tournament in Michigan that just happened. And the winner of that tournament was Paul Watson. Archimedes did a lot of work getting information about this. So I'm going to hand it over to him so you can introduce Paul Watson and his list and talk a little bit about what happened there with the Michigan Grand Tournament.
Yeah, so it looks like there was 22 players that ultimately played in the Michigan GT. It sounded like it was about 60-40 Rebels. I talked to Paul yesterday. He gave me the deal on his list, and then on the GT in general. The terrain was pretty dense, which we can talk about in a bit. But I think they probably were reacting from the Gen Con and Nova tables, which were the opposite of dense.
And rightly so.
Says the Imperial player.
Yeah.
So Paul's list is actually like just a pretty standard Wonder Twins list. This is very similar to the sort of Wonder Twins list that you saw at Gen Con and Nova. It's Luke and Leia. Luke's got Stims now, which is, now that that's out, that's a great upgrade on him. Stims, Force Push, Jedi Mind Trick. He's got two fleets with a scatter gun, two Z6s, two naked Rebel Troopers, and then two AT-RTs, one with a laser and one with a rotary.
I find it super interesting that there are no snipers in this list, to be frank, with them being legal now.
Yeah, that's kind of been like, what we've been seeing in Invader is everybody seems to think they're the hand of God. I'm not personally convinced of that yet, but I guess we'll see. Also, it's possible that given the terrain density on these Michigan GT tables, maybe they were not as useful as they would be on a different table.
I'm especially surprised that the snipers did not make an appearance for the Rebels, because the Rebels have had this constant problem, which is we have no reliable range four shooting apart from the Leia bombardment. And so without the snipers present, what do you do? And I guess the answer is you bring even more short range shooting with the double fleets and just hide.
Yeah, that's actually like a really interesting thing about this list to begin with. Most rebel lists that I've encountered over the past few months, like, they're only running one fleets, if they're running fleets at all, and this one's running two. I guess, you know, going back to the terrain, that's a big improvement in our quality of life for those fleets, making them a lot better.
Yeah, fleets definitely delete things at range two, which, you know, obviously their problem is always getting there.
It's so interesting that you drop down to 2z6. Like, that's extremely rare that you only see 2z6 in a list.
Yeah. I also find it interesting that, you know, from what it sounds like, there was a lot of armor in the meta overall. And the fact, I mean, that also probably contributed to the fact that he didn't take snipers. But that laser and rotary were probably much more effective in that regard.
Yeah, supposedly there were, of the 22 lists, a full half of them, 11, had some type of armor. 8 with ATRTs, 3 ATSTs, and then somebody actually brought a T-47.
Someone had the gall to bring a T-47 to a competitive event.
Somebody's got to have the stones, right?
Yeah.
And actually, that's 12 lists. I don't know if anything.
It's okay, we trust you.
Yeah. it's a huge contrast to Invader, where there was, what, one ATST?
Yeah, there was a single ATST in the elimination rounds for Invader League, and snipers were just everywhere.
Notably, for the elimination rounds, I believe there's more T-47s in Invader than ATSTs, because somebody's run up two.
Someone's running a double, so there's exactly 100% more ATST. Or sorry, T-47, excuse me.
But I think going back to the Michigan GT, you know, looking at the pictures of the terrain, and I think you alluded to this a little bit earlier, or there was a lot of terrain on these tables, and there were a lot of trees specifically, and like the big indoor trees that are like completely line of sight blocking. I think that that's like a really interesting thing to take a look at, because you can start putting units in like really weird positions that I don't know if that's good for competitive play. I think there's probably a lot more terrain on these tables than there maybe should have been. I don't know. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
They do look pretty crowded from what I'm seeing in the pictures. Almost too crowded in some cases. There's some of these Imperial boards which have a lot of junk scattered all over the place, but I mean, you can still maneuver an ATST through it. You know, ATSTs, because of the way that height works, right, they kind of ignore these low-lying structures, or they treat it as difficult terrain. They probably don't even care about, you know, a lot of the junk that's lying around that would otherwise have afforded cover to trooper units. But, you know, more places to shoot from is generally good, I think, because it lets people, you know, just use more of the map instead of sort of being, well, I can't go there because I'll just get shot down. No, so in that sense, more of the map becomes usable as you get more and more places to put your troops where you have at least a reasonable degree of safety. You're willing to kind of be a little more bold and a little less like, I can only stay here, I can only shoot from here attitude towards the map.
Yeah, I think, you know, if I had to choose between sparse terrain and dense terrain, I definitely think dense terrain makes for a much more interesting game.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more with that. I definitely prefer these tables over the ones we got at Nova and Gen Con, for sure.
Right, the Nova and Gen Con tables just, it's just too sparse. I mean, there were just some really sparse cases, but I mean, that topic's kind of been beaten to death. We don't have to go all the way back there and talk about the problems we had there, but that's fine, you know. Again, you know, more the merrier is generally the sentiment.
What do you guys think of the 14-point bid?
I think it's awesome. I think that's probably around where you want to be. If it's hard to tell based on the fact that we don't have a data set for what the rest of the bids at this specific tournament was. I know that in Invader, you know, if you're at 14, you're generally going to get blue player if you want it, which you should. So to that end, I think that 14 is a good place to be. I think any more than that, and you're probably giving up too much most of the time.
This is actually a great segue into another list that actually did it go undefeated, Orc, this other list run by Rich Segich.
Yeah, his was also undefeated.
His wow.
Second place list.
I agree. 14 is pretty extreme, but this list that Rick Segich brought sets the bar for extreme because it had a 20-point bid. I believe it was Luke and Han with triple SAB teams. It was just insane. Ork, you're the one that discovered this earlier today. You want to talk about what the contents are and some of your thoughts on it?
Yeah, so it's Luke and Han. Luke has push, reflexes, and stims, and then Han has a steam leader, duck, and cover, and stims. And then you got six Rebel Trooper squads with just the extra Rebel Trooper, no Z6s. I think that's the first Rebel list I've seen without a Z6 in it. And then three SAB strike teams, two of which have HQ uplink.
Yeah, it's not the first Rebel list that I've seen with no Z6s, but it's definitely the first Rebel list that's won anything that I've seen that hasn't had a Z6 in it.
Yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Yeah, it's the first like victorious non Z6 kind of list that's happened basically. Well, actually, that's not entirely true. Well, actually, no, that is true because the low Z6 count list that won at Gen Con did have, I think, one in it.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that this guy like essentially just didn't bring any heavy weapons in his trooper squads is just like, whoa. There's a lot to be said. The heavy weapons bring a lot to the table for each unit, and foregoing that advantage is interesting, but it clearly worked out for him.
Yeah, and if you're running a 20-point bid, you're really banking on your objective deck being used, which means, you know, to the extent that he has three SAB teams, he's obviously going to tailor his objectives and his deployments to favor, you know, being able to lay proton charges all over the map.
I love that he's like pushing the envelope in terms of like how little army can I take and still succeed.
For sure. I imagine that he cut recover the supplies would be my bet out of the objective deck. What do you guys think about that?
I don't think he did. Or did you?
Yeah, so he actually cut intercept.
He cut intercept. That's interesting. Okay.
I can dig that.
And in fact, one of his wins was recover.
Luke is just really good at playing the middle game with the box. That's what I found.
That's true. I don't know. I just like in a meta where like just about every Rebel list is running Luke or some form of commandos with speed movement increases, it feels like relying on the box in the middle of the map could be dicey. Especially if your list is geared towards just like defending a position.
Yeah, battling for the middle is certainly only like one level of the recover game. There was actually a really good game in Invader League between, I think it was Luke from Master of the Force, and I forget what his opponent's name was, but it was during the round robin phase. I think it was against Finn, where you had the opportunity to duel with Luke in the middle, but he instead decided to cut around to the side, and ultimately won him the game because of the vulnerable box carriers on the outside of the center, on the left side of the center. He was able to kind of just pilot his Luke into a position where he didn't have to make the hard choice. Am I going to duel my opponent's Luke? He was able to exploit a flank or a vulnerability in the way his opponent had deployed instead of just trying to win by brute force.
Yeah, and that's actually potentially a good strategy in recovery in general. You know, usually the thought is you have two safe boxes and your opponent has two safe boxes and you're basically fighting over the middle, which is usually what happens. But you should still sort of, you know, be aware of opportunities to snag one of your opponent's boxes if they leave it too lightly defended and you have something in the vicinity that can go after it.
For sure. I think that if that's the game I'm thinking of, I believe I watched it. And I think that what enabled that was, I think that they had a major offensive deployment, which everything was like really close together as opposed to like having battle lines with recover or like advanced positions and stuff. So I think that flank in that case might have been a little bit more exposed, but I do generally agree that being able to exploit those flanks is a big deal if you can make it happen.
And strike teams, well, not just strike teams, but commandos in general are also potentially very good on recover because of that scout move.
Scout plus the Leia command card is really quite the combo, as you showed me the other night.
Yeah, Dash and I played a practice game the other day. We had advanced positions, so the Scout 2 became Scout 3. So I moved a commando squad, Scout 3, to the center, and then did No Time for Sorrows, and they were physically touching the middle box before the game even started.
That's amazing.
It was amazing. Our Lord and Savior, Darth Vader, then chased them down and slaughtered them all. Retrieved the box, and we still lost, but it's okay. But anyways, it was interesting.
Devil still won the day.
That's actually a good anecdote from, you know, just a few seconds ago, because ultimately the reason you still lost is because I was able to contest your home boxes.
Absolutely. Your snipers pulled my guys apart that were on the other side of the map. You weren't even relatively close to my guys with the boxes. You just were able to shoot my guys off the boxes, and they just dropped.
Yep. There's a AT-RT over there. But yeah.
All right. So last but not least for this Michigan GT section, we're going to talk a little bit about the painting requirements. We're going to just touch briefly on this. They had a strict three-color painting requirement for the Michigan GT. All events in the Michigan GT had this three-color painting requirement according to their rules. They released a document regarding this, and there's been a little bit of controversy, I think, over, you know, should we create a painting requirement for people to come play the game? But I'd like to hear your guys' thoughts on this. I think you know, at my home store, I've heard this argument before, but these are from people who don't really have a 40K background. They say, you know, I should be able to use the models I bought. There shouldn't be like an extra requirement or extra thing imposed on me to actually use my models in tournament, especially if I'm paying for a ticket to the event. But if you're someone with a 40K background, this is sort of like, you know, that's just what you do. It's like part of the hobby. But I'm wondering how you guys feel about that.
So I'm not quite as maybe that far to that side of the argument. I do think that Fantasy Flight came out with a rule set for maximum firepower events that essentially states that you can bring non-painted models. I think that whatever they end up doing with this, whether it's going to continue to be in that, it should be static across all maximum firepower events. I also have a little bit of an issue with requiring models to be painted, especially if there are release windows that take place like right before an event. Like, I believe Boba and Scouts were illegal for this event. And if they were, you know, people had like 5 days to paint them, which as someone who takes a long time to paint things myself, that's, I don't know, that's asking a lot, but that's just my 2 cents.
Yeah, there was a little bit of speculation that the lack of snipers was at least partially due to the painting requirement, that people just couldn't get them together in time.
That makes sense to me.
I did hear, though, too, that there was, and you see this, too, in 40K with the three-color minimum, but there was some very baseline three-color minimums going on. You know, base coat, a different colored wash, and then, you know, like, paint the guy's hat kind of situations.
Oh, interesting.
Dunk him in some black paint, paint a stripe on him, paint the base or something.
Right. I mean, technically, that's three colors. That's I think one weakness of, you know, the three color minimum. But generally speaking, coming from a 40K background, people do try for the most part and make their armies look good. But I also think with a game like Legion, where you have a lot of converts from, you know, X-Wing and Armada and other SFG games, where there is no hobby aspect, I think probably in the first year of the game, that might be a little bit too much to ask of the community to show up with everything painted. But, you know, I don't personally mind it, just because I'm used to it from 40K. And, you know, for me, the hobby aspect is half the fun. But I could definitely see, you know, especially with Legion being so new, why people would have a problem with it.
And I mean, especially if you're playing the game at kind of like a higher level, I think it's just adding to it to have your models painted. And especially when, you know, this is kind of touching on a larger subject, maybe a little bit stretches into maybe our play to win segment and our self-improvement segment. But like, as someone who plays at a high level, I think it behooves you to be an ambassador for the game you play and to, you know, treat people with respect and also respect the hobby and sort of like, you know, maybe this is one of the traditions of the hobby, which is having a painted army and having something that looks good on the table in addition to being a good player.
I certainly couldn't agree more with that. You know, I think that, especially when we're talking about getting new people into the game or people that are, you know, playing 40K or whatever, to join the game, like, it's, I don't know what the force multiplier here is, but if you show up to a demo game with painted models as opposed to not painted models, I think the buy-in you're going to get is a lot higher, from that ambassador standpoint.
Undoubtedly. All right. So I think that about covers our feelings on painting, unless there's some last minute ad that I missed. Orky, good?
Yep.
All right. So we're going to move on now to the Invader League, since this is a part two of our discussion of the current Legion competition events and things like that. For those of you that are not familiar, the Invader League is an online league. We're able to play this game with people all around the world through the software called Tabletop Simulator. A gentleman named Tyrion created the mod version of Legion. He also created a bunch of maps with terrain pieces to play on, as well as people from the community of those that are selling 3D prints, terrain buildings and such. We're able to provide him with renders and model files for these maps. We're able to really simulate real life tables in this mod. And we run, or not we run, but there has been a league going on since last year. Of every 6 months, there's an online league where you get people to enter and they get seeded into groups. The groups play, and then you pick the top two from each group, and those people make up a bracket, and those people then play single elimination bracket. So we are currently in season two, and we are well into the elimination phase because we've played several of these first initial elimination rounds. And the games have been really awesome. A new development this year has been streaming the games more regularly online, both on the Invader League Twitch channel and on my channel. And there's a couple of others. Stabcast has a channel. A gentleman by the name of R1H4 has a channel. So there's all kinds of great places you can go to watch video on demand of the games that have already been played, as well as catch a live game that's coming up later on. But we're here to talk about the competitive aspects of it. And so we're thinking about... the list, how in Invader League we had a bunch more snipers than we had seen at the Michigan GT. We're also able to play with spoiled content. There is a way to simulate future content into our Invader League game, so we're able to get some time on the simulated table with things like the FD cannon, things like Wookiees, and we get a little bit of a preview to see how that might impact the game going forward. But we're thinking about, you know, what are some of our favorite moments from the first round? And I have a very easy one. And I'll let Dash and Orc tell theirs, but I'm going to keep mine in reserve. Mine's about the Boba Fett bounty that wasn't. But I'd like to have Dash and Orc go first and talk about their favorite moment, perhaps, from the first round of the second season elimination phase.
I was going to do that one, but No. You go ahead. I got.
Okay, you do.
I think mine was probably it was actually the very first match that was streamed. It was Chaplin and Starscream. So Chaplin's list is a little bit of an eclectic rebel list: Han and Leia, a bunch of rebel troopers, and then two units of Wookiees. And then Starscream had. It was basically like an Imperial Toys list. He had Veers, Baba, and an AT-ST all in one list. They were playing Sabotage, Moisture Evaporators, and Barra's list didn't really have any impact at all to deal with the AT-ST. But he essentially just ran his Wookiees up one flank towards Starscream's, one of his two home Moisture Evaporators. And it was a very like Russian style, you know, throw as much fur at it as you can manage. And Starscream just couldn't kill enough Wookiees to keep them off of one of his Moisture Evaporators. And on turn six, one of those Wookiees with like 2 health left dropped the last wound token on one of those operators. So I think that was my favorite one so far.
Wow. So like the sort of clutch Wookiee dropping the wound at the last second.
Yeah, basically Wookiee's just, you know, taking fire from an AT-ST and charging straight into the breach. It takes a long time to chew through 12 wounds, let me tell you.
Yeah, it does.
Especially when you bring 3 squads of them. Like a, certain person in the eliminations is doing right now.
Yeah, let's, we can talk about that later.
Yeah, we can. How about you, Dash? What's your, one of your favorite moments from a single elim so far?
I have to say, I think it was the game between Nikki Myland and Freaky Fingers. It was an Imperial versus Imperial matchup. I believe both lists were running Boba, but Nikki was running 3 sets of bikes. And, you know, there had been a lot of speculation in Vader and tabletop, or Discord rather, that bikes were just dead because snipers were a thing. And, Nikki just, the bikes destroyed everything. It was really awesome to see those speeder bikes just annihilate everything in their path, even with snipers on the other side of the table to deal with them. He did get disarray, which was clearly very advantageous for him, having 3 bikes and Boba Fett. But the degree at which it was effective was really inspiring to see.
Yeah, I think he won that game, what, like 8-0?
Yeah, it was 8-0. It was a breakthrough, I believe. So it was certainly some like pretty perfect setup conditions, and the disarray breakthrough with 3 bikes and Boba is like where you want to be. But he was very close to tabling his opponent that game.
Nikki has a little bit of a reputation for being the bike man, a little, you know, back home in England. He's from the UK, so he and Ellis are both like some of the top rated players in the UK. They have a lot of practice together, and I believe when Ellis and I were casting one of his last games, the one that we actually had the chance to cast the game that where my favorite moment is from, he was saying how Nikki was like disarray is one of his favorite conditions, and how he really tries hard to make sure he gets it because he just knows how strong bikes can be in the flanking posture, and it's pretty clear they just get even stronger with Boba backing them up just to get that extra finishing blow.
Yeah, it was really strong. You know, Freaky's army was split into 2 pieces, and the bikes and Boba just ate 1 piece at a time. Just got ended really quickly.
Absolutely.
So, what is your favorite moment on this?
All right, well, okay, so I had the privilege of streaming one of Nikki's games, and he was also playing Barrer from Archimedes' favorite moment as well. Barrer, you know, running his Wookiees and things like that he was running with, you know, kind of Rebel kitchen sink style list, coming up against, you know, Nikki's kind of hyper-specialized bikes and Boba, you know, does one thing really, really well, and then you kind of hammer an anvil where you've got the bikes and Boba as your hammer, and you've got the Veers with the steam bleeder and DLTs as your anvil. It got to the point where Leia was pretty close to losing out on the bounty, and it was recover the supplies, and it was on Kashyyyk, which is one of the worst single elimination maps for the bike list that Nikki brought. But Nikki, you know, played like a boss. He was crushing the game, but he wasn't doing the objectives. He didn't really have time to do all the objectives. So he was actually behind in objectives for the majority of the game. And it came into the middle of the game where he realized, okay, well, Leia's vulnerable. I can collect the bounty on her, and that'll help me cement the win. And in the moment where he needed Boba to get on her, one of the Wookiees ran up to intercept Boba Fett. And so Boba got tied up in melee, and he'd already spent his whipcord the turn before. So Boba was having trouble extricating himself from that position. Well, the turn, you know, before this awesome event happened, Boba had finally killed off that last Wookiee and been freed up to attack Leia and secure the bounty token. Well, Barrer, seeing this was about to happen, played No Time for Sorrows to win priority against Imperial Discipline for Nikki, wins the priority, moves Leia up, shoots a unit of troopers, gets a couple kills, and then walks Leia off the board to deny the bounty token to the Boba Fett player. So he just suicides Leia. She only has one wound and just walks her off and says, nope, no bounty for you. And it's completely legal to wrap three units off the board. So that was a tremendous, tremendously funny moment. I think Nikki and I were just crying laughing. It was amazing to watch that happen.
Yeah, I think I was watching that too. It was pretty hilarious to see happen.
That is both a very comical and surprisingly effective way to actually deny someone a bounty.
Yeah, it's like you wouldn't think it was good on its face, but actually it's pretty legitimate if you know the bounty is going to be the difference between victory and defeat. And if you can spare 90 points, well, might as well.
Yeah, it's definitely better to give up 90 points than in a tie game than an actual victory point, for sure. Assuming you can spend it on breakers.
And assuming your unit is almost dead, you certainly don't want to walk a full house Leia off the board just because she has a bounty on her.
Yeah. This Leia, on the other hand, was 1 point from death, and so right. she was definitely not going to be alive by the end of that turn. So it was kind of it was one of those weird situations where the cost of doing something was like low enough to actually do it. It was one of those kind of marketing decisions.
I mean, it was definitely the right
decision. Yeah, it was the right decision for sure. All right, so those were some of our favorite moments in the single elimination rounds. I'd like to just remind our audience that they can tune into twitch.tv/invaderleague if they want to check out some more of those VODs, or twitch.tv/YavinBase if they want to check out VODs of the single elimination rounds from the Invader League. But speaking of checking out VODs, Dashes, you're our resident Imperial player, and there was an Imperial mirror that happened between BG Moore and Bees, also known as Captain Ahab on Steam. But I wanted you to talk about this game as a game to watch because it had some great Imperial play in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, I was just kind of interested in the lists they took were a little bit, generic. You know, I think they both took Veers, Boba, and a bunch of snipers, and I think the max on core units. Overall, you know, I believe, was this the game that you nominated that mountain as Clutch Mountain? Or am I thinking of it?
This was a different one. This was actually on Bespin, where the two of them were dueling Bobas for a while. And I think this is one where I think Bees actually sniped off Veers to get the bounty token. Gotcha. Sniped him with a backpack rocket to secure the bounty.
Yeah, I mean, it was just an interesting game in general. I don't have a ton to say about it. Sure. I don't know.
I think the reason that I sort of think that this is a, you know, if you watch one stream game, watch this one type of game, is it was, for the most part, on both sides, a very cleanly played game by both players. You know, their fundamentals were very sound. I also think BG Moore in particular exhibited very clever and effective use of HQ uplinks on his sniper teams.
That's for sure. The uplink sniper teams were extremely effective in this game. I think that, with that being said, like, both players were playing pretty safe overall. The aggressiveness of both players, I thought, was... I mean, the lists are not very aggressive. They're just six core units, snipers, and like Boba is the aggressive piece, which I think is fine. It's kind of like a Vader replacement in that regard.
So before we move on from that, let's talk briefly about why HQ uplink is good in that list and then another list. And I think the biggest reason is because depending on some of the language, you can use uplink to kind of expand the benefit of certain command cards. So in this case, it was Imperial Discipline that because of the way that Imperial Discipline is worded, the unit that uplinks gets to recover its own uplink.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a certainly very important aspect to the snipers and uplink in general for these lists. But I think that with giving your snipers uplink generally, making sure that your snipers take the shot when they need to take the shot is very important. And leaving it up to chance can sometimes end up kind of biting you, especially when, you know, you need to really be shooting at things in light cover or no cover to really be maximizing the effectiveness of them. So making sure that you catch the units that you need to catch when they're in the open makes the uplinks very good on them as opposed to some other units that you can go to.
Yeah, and on that first turn, you know, when you're often sort of potentially engaged in a sniper war with your opponent, if they also brought snipers, you know, like in this game, B's played maximum fire. They both played maximum firepower, but BG Moore had the uplinks. So B's was basically fishing for sniper tokens. Meanwhile, BG Moore was activating, you know, all three of his snipers consecutively and just picking off B's snipers before he ever pulled the special forces token.
And it gets even stronger going into the middle of the turn, because now that the snipers have all gone, you've successfully delayed your entire set of core units. So now if they have to walk into you because they're not able to control that like you are.
For sure. I will say that I think that overall, lists that can afford to, A, if you're taking three snipers, or if you're taking any amount of snipers, if you can afford to give them the order token on turn one, it's really important if there's a sniper war possibility. You know, I think, like, for instance, the list I'm running in Vader is Vader, six core units, and three snipers. I think that it, you know, generally speaking, if I'm in a mirror where there's three snipers on each side, like, assault turn one for and all of it going on snipers is not out of the question.
Is this a good segue to briefly talk about our invader lists?
Absolutely. This would be the time. So each of us is actually in the single eliminations in Invader League, being the competitive people we are. So let's go ahead and just start with dashes, because you have a game scheduled for Saturday.
I do. So I am playing the list that I've dubbed the 501st Legion. Creative, I know. It is Darth Vader with Force Reflexes, Force Push, and Saber Throw. It is two snowtrooper squads with flame troopers, one of which has an extra snowtrooper, four stormtrooper squads with DLTs, and then three strike team commando squads with snipers. And this is really just an all corners list. I think Vader is. It clearly centers around Vader. He's my key piece. Whenever I'm making a move, he's generally in the middle of it. Overall, the idea behind this list, notably, it also has a 13-point bid. So it's kind of an all-comers, hopefully get the blue player and be able to take advantage of that in the various ways that's advantageous. Making sure that I have enough units with Vader to kind of combat the rebel activations that we have seen kind of steadily grow over the course of Legion's lifetime so far. I think most rebel lists are like running a minimum of 10. Confirm, deny?
Yeah, confirm.
I've seen a couple of it, like 12, which is kind of scary. And getting out-activated generally was my biggest fear going into Elims. So I wanted to make sure that I had a solid 10 activations that all could be effective and do things. That's where I'm at. I do have a game Saturday. I believe it is at 11 EST. Maybe our man Endless here will stream it.
We'll probably wake up early for that one to stream it and make it sure it's available for people to watch. Orc, you want to talk about your list now? The Vader is awesome, but of course, you know, I'm a Rebel player at heart, so I want to hear about your Rebel inspiration here. What have you brought to the single eliminations?
Well, I actually don't think it's very inspired. It's basically just Wonder Twins 2.0. It's Luke, Leia, five troopers with C6, two sniper strike teams, and a unit of Wookiees with a bowcaster. So it's 10 activations. I have a 12-point bid, one less than Dash.
Gotcha.
Yeah. I feel that we have a meeting in the future where you outbid me by 1 point and get key positions. And then the circle is now complete.
Yes. The master has become the apprentice.
Speaking of master apprentice, can I just give props to the two of you? I forgot to mention that you guys are number one and number two seed in the league. Like, I don't think we mentioned that.
Well, thank you. You are also the number six seed. We are all in the top eight. So I think that there's a lot of skill here overall.
So, yeah. so we'll just take that little moment to pat ourselves on the back. Or can we just continue?
Actually, for the longest, I was really torn about this list because I sort of thought there could be a lack of armor generally and impact in the elims, just because of where things were going and how much everyone wanted to try snipers, which turned out to be mostly true. The problem is there's so much impact baked into imperialists, even if you look at what's essentially like a, you know, no intentional impact Veer's Bobble list. You still have, you know, the two command cards, the rocket and maximum firepower, and then you have, you know, generally at least four DLTs plus impact grenades from snowtroopers. So ultimately I chickened out and went with Wonder Twins. I could not cast off the shackles of Skywalker. But I do think a really interesting list would be Leia with a bunch of Rebel Troopers, some snipers, and then three rotary ATRTs. You can do that with like 11 or 12 activations. And it's just, I tested this in some practice games, including the one we talked about earlier. And it's just, it is so much range 3 firepower. It's ridiculous.
So I do want to kind of touch on, you know, we had talked before Invader about kind of like you were kind of waffling between those two lists. Are you happy with the choice that you ended up making now that you've kind of seen the meta shake out a little bit?
I think I am, just because, you know, especially where I'm in the bracket, I have behind me, I have two Imperials. So I was guaranteed to play an Imperial player in the first round. And those ATRTs are definitely not nearly as effective against an Imperial as they are against a Rebel player. So, you know, I'm trying to take this thing one round at a time. And I certainly don't want to, you know, hopefully not get bounced in my first game. So I brought what I thought would be more effective against an Imperial. And that's also what I'm more comfortable with. You know, Wonder Twins is my jam, what I'm used to. So, you know, every time I use Luke, I'm constantly surprised at how much work that boy can do by himself.
He is one of those models that can put the whole army on his back if need be.
For sure. So I think it's a boring list. I think it's also an effective list, which is why it's boring, because, you know, it's kind of the template that most Rebel players start with these days. Although I think we're going to start seeing more variety now that Han and Commandos are out.
For sure.
I completely agree. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to ask you what you brought.
Oh, what I brought? Well, nothing special. So I love Han as a model. I think he's one of the better models. And I'm a little bit of contrarian. I have kind of a contrarian tendency when it comes to building lists for competitive. So as soon as Han came out, I decided, you know, hey, I'm going to try a list without Luke. I'm going to just play Han and Leia together. And I really fell in love with that archetype. But then I realized that you know, if you just take them together without a threatening unit in melee, you know, Luke can kind of just run the roost on you. And same with Vader, like they don't feel that threatened by units like Luke and Leia because of their pierce immunity and the fact that they just tear them up. You know, Vader with a saber throw against, you know, either Han or Leia has the potential to eat half their health pool in a single attack, which is never good. And then, of course, I didn't like paying the sort of esteemed leader tax, because not only does esteemed leader on two units cost you 10 points, it also has a tension between taking heavy weapons on your normal troopers. So I decided not to go with that. Instead, I decided to add Chewbacca, and so I'm running Han, Leia, and Chewie for my single elimination games. During the season, I had played it with Han, Leia, Chewie, and a Z6 spam with FD turrets because the snipers weren't legal. So I had, you know, I had an enormous bid. I had like a 14-point bid, and, you know, I was doing the thing where you outbid people and, you know, put your FD cannons in places that can't avoid them and just fire downrange at them and force them to come to me, play kind of defensively. But because snipers came out and the FD kind of fell off, I got in kind of a little bit of a stuck place. And I'm like, well, what am I going to replace this FD cannon with? And how am I going to work snipers into my list? So eventually I settled on two units of scattergun fleets that are bare bones, just because the scattergun fleets are very efficient and they do a ton of damage. And I already have a lot of range 2 shooting with Pierce, but you know, Pierce is just really good. And plus I had 2 Imperials at minimum for my first 2 games, likely. Actually, I know it now, it's going to be 2 Imperials in a row because both of the mirror matches are going to happen. And, you know, one of them is going to come out and it's going to be Imperial for sure. So I waffle between Han, Leia, Chewie, 2 scattergun fleets, 3 Z6, 1 naked, 2 snipers for 11 activations with a very small bid just to outbid, you know, in case of a Weiss or in case of like a max points Boba. To just have that small bid to try to, you know, go in the middle. Like, well, someone was going to commit with a huge bid. I wasn't going to win anyway because I needed all the units instead. Plus, I discovered the beauty of improvised orders on Leia. So that was also a big factor in why I chose what I chose. Improv is really good. Like, really, really, really good. So that's what I'm running, and I haven't played my first game yet. I have my first game on Thursday, and I'm going to be playing against Bees, the gentleman with the Boba, and the Boba snipers list. So I'll be excited. I love Han against an archetype like that just because of the Pierce, and I'm very Pierce heavy, so I feel like my chances to win that are pretty good. So that's the long explanation for a short list. All right.
So I have one question for you.
Yeah, please.
You said you didn't want to pay the esteemed leader tax, but you paid like 100 points for it.
I paid for the walking carpet that is Chewbacca. Well, Chewbacca brings so much to my list, though, because he's got range 3 shooting, he's got crit surge, he's got impact, he's got pierce, he's got Guardian 3, and he's got Notorious Scoundrels, which is the name of this podcast. So how could I not play it?
There we go. I think, all jokes aside, I think Chewie's very effective. And I think that a lot of people aren't giving him enough credit for what he's worth on the table yet.
Yeah, people are bagging on him in the Discord, man. They don't like him.
No, I honestly don't know why. You know, he's got a lot of hit points. The amount of times I've seen his ranged attack almost wipe an entire squad of like stormtroopers is high. You know, I don't know. I think he's definitely worth it.
No, my regret was that I didn't have enough points for Hunter.
Yeah, you ended up, you shook up at what, like 14 point bid-ish?
Well, I'm at 796 now.
Right, because tabletop doesn't shoot.
I did like a small bid.
Yeah, so you're at 4. Yeah, I guess you don't have the points for Hunter. Nope. That sucks, man.
It does. Hunter's good, but it's only somewhat good. It's better going the other direction that Han gives aim tokens to Chewie rather than Chewie gives aim tokens to Han, because Han doesn't really need an aim. His dice are so accurate.
For sure. So I think this is actually an interesting segue that you guys seem to be talking about beating up on Imperials. You're like, oh, we're definitely facing Imperials in the second round, so we're going to tool our lists out. And I think that one of the most interesting things to see out of Invader this season is that we have like a new Wonder Twins-esque list, except it's on the other side of the table now. In Avir's Boba, you know, a bunch of core units, and some people are taking snipers, some people are taking bikes. But I think it's really cool to see that list develop this last season. And people are using it to be very to a high effect.
Yeah, nobody has yet to come up with a good nickname for the Vera's Bobble list, but I think it's so ubiquitous that it needs one.
I agree. I think that it's getting there. I don't know. It's like,
it's really good at killing characters because of the maximum firepower backpack rocket snipers combo. There's a lot of long range damage.
I mean, to that effect, like between those two command cards, like not even characters, but you're just essentially, those two command cards can delete 2 units from the board if they go off, so especially Boba's, but can delete like 2 trooper units from the board in long range shots that really you're not going to get shot back at from. That's really effective.
Absolutely. So I mean, we'll have to think of a nickname for it because we don't really quite have one just yet.
Yeah, listeners, if you have one, let us know.
Yeah, please. We would love to. We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. We've come up with super friends for Hanlei and Chewie, but Boba Beers deserves its own nickname.
Imperial Bros. I don't know. That sounds kind of lame, but
something like that. All right. So our last segment, and our it is going to be our last segment because we have about 15 minutes left. An article was written. I'm trying to figure out where this article came from. It was in the design journal of the FFG game developers. I think that's where it was from.
Yeah. And I believe it was specifically categorized as a Legion article, though I may be wrong about that.
It definitely shows up on the Legion page.
So I think that, first of all, if you haven't read the article, you should do so. It's a really good article about self-improvement, I think, more than anything else, and making sure that your priorities are in the right place when you're playing a game like Legion. And I think that the author really hits a lot of the key points as far as, you know, playing to win at all cost is like super unproductive.
Yeah, basically he says, you know, the object of winning ultimately is a result, and you're doing results oriented thinking, where you really should be, if you want to become a better player, you should be focusing on process oriented thinking. Because, you know, in any game with variance, Legion has dice, you know, you can in theory do everything correct and still lose. And if you get sort of like too focused on winning, you know, as a result, it can lead both to, you know, unproductive self-improvement and also kind of a negative play attitude.
I found the article here, actually. It's called I Play to Win is a Lie, from Nate French, who wrote it. This was the September 28th, 2018 Designer Journal. And the four opening lines are games meant to be won? If not, why do we play games that have strong competitive scenes? Which is an interesting hook.
Yeah, I mean, so I played a lot of Magic in my day. And while clearly the cards don't translate, but a lot of the skill sets and ideas specifically behind this article are kind of like held very highly in that community, and that, you know, more so I think in Magic than maybe Legion, you know, the variance is a lot higher, or at least it feels a lot higher, and it, you know, sometimes you make all of the right calls and you lose, and you can't let that get in the way of, you know, you learning that knowing that I made the right call, it didn't work out, but the next time that you come to that fork in the road where you need to make that call again, you need to understand and have learned from your past interaction with it that you still need to make the right call even if it didn't work out for you last time.
And the inverse is true also, where you can, you know, make mistakes ultimately and still win. And just because you won a game doesn't mean you shouldn't still go back and look at that game, you know, and see what mistakes you made and what you can learn from those mistakes.
There's a quotation in the middle of the article. If you quote Andrew Brokos from Thinking Poker, which is another podcast, the end result of you winning the pot does not change the fact that the way you played the hand was a complete disaster. Yeah. So it's good to be cognizant of these mistakes that still net you wins, and make a conscious effort to go back and fix them.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, not to, you know, tout the Invader League horn too loudly, but it's been really great to essentially have my matches streamed and then be able to go back and watch them on a VOD and see like the criticisms that other people have of my play, so that I can kind of learn from them, from maybe not an unbiased source, but at least a source that's not myself. Because when you're kind of like sitting there in the game, the right decision might not be clear until you really kind of detach yourself from exactly what happened and the emotions you were feeling in that moment and that sort of thing.
I think my big takeaway from this article is sort of, you know, what's the logical conclusion of the process of looking at a game of Legion as focusing on limiting your own mistakes and then capitalizing on opponents' mistakes, is that, you know, ultimately, if your goal is to improve your play, your opponent is not someone, you know, necessarily to crush or dominate. They're an ally in your quest for self-improvement. Essentially, they're a mirror against which you can measure yourself. You know, not someone to, you know, like win and then throw the dice at and say, I'm better than you.
You know, there's a galactic civil war going on, right?
I like to think of this as a light side view on how to play Legion. If you want to have your, you know, your Sith views, that's fine.
Feel the hate flow through you.
It brings up an interesting point. You know, I know that from my experience practicing X-Wing and practicing Legion, I know that, you know, in that scenario where there is nothing on the line but learning, then the two of you are playing as if you are partners in the realization of an art form, and that art form being a well-played game, whatever the game is in front of you, be that Legion, be that X-Wing, you know, it could be chess, it could be any of these things, but that doesn't work for everyone when they actually get to the tournament setting. Sometimes you have to, you know, just play with extreme caution and play with extreme awareness, and your opponent is not always your friend. That's absolutely true.
I will say that, you know, a lot of the main points of this article are great. You know, treating your opponents with respect, making sure that, you know, this is a hobby. This is, you know, it's also competitive, but, you know, making sure that we maintain kind of the atmosphere that this article promotes is very important. Just for the health of the game in general. You know, a lot of other games have been kind of tainted by some of these events of, you know, cheating or whatnot. And, you know, if everybody kind of takes this mentality of you don't need to win at all costs, we're improving ourselves, a lot of those problems just kind of go away.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think the sportsmanship conversation is sort of a good extension of this. In that, you know, even though you're in a contest where, like, in a tournament, you know, if you're, say you're playing for, like, an Adepticon invite, obviously the result of winning, you know, could be very important to you personally, but that doesn't mean that you can't or shouldn't still treat your opponent with respect.
So, like, when your friend faces you in round one and key positions you out of an Adepticon invite, you should still be nice to them?
Well, you know, let's not get into the past here.
Fair enough. I will say that I do have one kind of gripe with this article, in that, you know, it starts to go into like variance and hidden information and logical choices and things like that. And I think some of the points break down, specifically when we get into the idea behind cards like change of plans and command cards in general. There is an aspect to it where you are playing your opponent and not just yourself. You know, moving troops around the board and making sure that you take the statistically correct shots and making sure that your actions are effective as possible. Like those are all things that can be kind of measured, and you made sure that you did the right thing. But when you get into command card play and bluffing and things like that, playing against your opponent is important. Especially when you kind of get into the game of, you know, he thinks I'm going to do this, but I think he's going to do that, or, you know, you can go down that rabbit hole any number of levels. And whoever wins that kind of sub game can have some very dramatic advantages on the battlefield. So I think, I don't know, that's my two cents on that.
There's also something to be said of not playing for reads and just playing for things you know are good. Because you can try to read, but then if your read is wrong, you can get completely punished for making a bad read. So it's never like a good idea to play on reads alone, or to be, let yourself get baited, or let yourself, be talked out of, in your own internal monologue, talk yourself out of, I guess, dialogue in this case, because you're talking to yourself, but your own internal dialogue, and sort of not let yourself be talked out of making the correct decision because you think there's a, you have some chance of winning through a kind of gamey method, or through, playing this, game of tells or some other thing. Cause you may just in fact be playing, Rufus and Doofus, someone who's not terribly good at the end of the day, and you can outthink yourself a little bit. There's always that danger of just making a read that you think is good, and it's actually just, you don't have a clue because you are overestimating what's happening.
Yeah, that's kind of like the equivalent of, in football, you've got the ball on the 1 yard line, and of course everyone expects you to do a run play, so instead you do a pass play, but then the ball gets intercepted.
We're looking at you, Seattle Seahawks. Yeah, as a Patriots fan, thank you.
And the reason that everyone expects you to do a run play is because most of the time a run play works in that situation. So,
especially when you've got Marshawn Lynch,
Right. Yeah. So I think you can definitely, we could spend a whole episode on the change of plans command card. But I think you can definitely overthink situations like that sometimes.
For sure. And I think that, 85% of the time, or some arbitrarily high percentage, it's not right to overthink that sort of thing. But when you get into the higher echelons of play, that's the sort of, the command card bluffing and stuff like that can start to make or break games. When you're playing against opponents that, are doing, 99% of the everything right, you have to find those kind of competitive edges places and bluffing and things like that. That's an area of the game that can be exploited to some degree against your opponent.
Right, and even though I mentioned the idea of Rufus and Doofus just a second ago, you still have to play with respect. You still have to be aware of things that could happen to you on any given play, and account for them. And but not too much. Don't not take the play that you see. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Don't shy away because you're afraid of them doing something.
If you can force push Luke off the board, you should probably do it. Don't think yourself out of that one.
Absolutely. Well, we are coming up on the hour mark, so I think it is about time for us to wrap this episode up. Any last words from either of you before we get that going?
I would just ask, this is definitely geared to be a podcast that talks about competitive play. All of the listeners out there, however many of you there may be, if you could just, essentially drop us a line, a question that you might want answered that has to do with competitive play, a weird situation that came up. We're kind of looking for some of those to talk about during other podcasts or, down the line. So if you've got something you want the three of us to talk about, send it our way.
I'll just say grats to the undefeated players from Michigan's UG. We'll see you guys at Adepticon, and watch some. Those of you out there that are watching Invader League, watch some matches this week. All three of us should play over the course of the next 10 days or so. Unless I don't think we don't actually know who our first opponent's going to be. But we should figure that out in the next few days here.
Yeah, I think we will know who that is pretty soon.
In general, I just recommend getting on the Legion Discord, just because it is we can link it in the show notes. But it's a great forum for discussion about Legion. It's not just for, competitive Legion. There's people post hobby stuff and all kinds of things. So
we have an awesome miniatures channel and terrain channel where people post some of their creations and give feedback to each other about, what sort of, things can be done. We learn a lot back and forth about this sort of thing.
I also want to just quick give some props to Talk Polite, LJ Pena, who's running the Invader League, for setting this thing up and doing such a good job.
He's also TOing at LVO. So that's going to be really cool to have him TO a live event that is a Maximum Firepower on top of what he's doing with the Invader League. So we'll be able to take all the lessons we learned here and apply those to Invader League.
And those tables and also the prize support look freaking amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's already put some photos out there of the potential tables, so they look great.
If you haven't signed up for LVO and you can go, you should. I have already bought my plane ticket and hotel room, so I'll see you there.
Try not to get bounced in the first round by key positions.
Hey, man. Never again.
All right, you kids play nice. Okay. All right, so that's going to wrap up for this first episode of Notorious Scoundrels. We hope you've enjoyed listening to us, and we'll be back next time with more. For Notorious Scoundrels, my name is Endless, and we will catch you all next time here with myself, Dashes, and Archimedes. Thanks for listening.
Peace out.
Later.
Join us next time for another edition of the Notorious Scoundrels podcast. This has been a Fifth Trooper production.